Father, I thank you for this day. I thank you for all these precious people, fearfully and wonderfully made, and so special. I ask your blessing upon each one, and I ask you for your help as I share a few things, Lord. Use it all for your purposes as you see fit in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right. The designated heckler can unmute themselves if they can be quiet so that I don't feel like I'm in a sensory deprivation chamber. Because if you ever watch the movie, you find that people begin to lose their minds in those things. And if you haven't watched the movie, please don't. I'm not even going to tell you what it's called. Well, now that I think of it, I will mention the name of the movie, but only for a theological and spiritual purpose. The name of the movie is Altered States. And so from there, what I want to say is that one day, very early in human history, I don't know how many hours had passed. I'd like to think it was at least a week. The condition of mankind was altered, and after that, they lived in an altered state. It, however, was God's plan to bring back to its true nature what had been denatured by sin and death and by the deception of Satan. So we are now caught up in the grand drama of that playing out, and it's been playing out for a very long time. God has never lost control. He's never been defeated by anyone. He's never had to go back to the drawing board and come up with a plan B. He's just marching right on ahead with what he set out to do from the beginning. And he hasn't gotten tired, and he hasn't gotten old and worn out. And he's still absolutely holy, perfect, glorious, righteous, just, and very kind. And he gives grace. Yeah. He gives grace, and he keeps on giving grace. And in a way that's similar to a waterfall. Have you ever stood at the bottom of a waterfall? Well, if you think of what's coming over the falls as grace, how much of it lands on you just depends on where you're sitting. If you sit at the bottom of the waterfall, now don't think about the ones that would crush you with so much water and blast you out all the way to the sea. I'm talking, think of a more gentle one for the purposes of the illustration. If, or even as a shower in you know, your shower, the water falls upon you if you stand in the flow. And so God doesn't direct his grace away from you as you try to draw near. He just leaves it there flowing, and you can step into it. The grace is there for everyone. And it's particularly there in a moment where you feel like there's no grace. It's just as real. So anyway, the Lord is in the process of altering the state that we're in and making it more and more like that of his son, Yeshua. And he is doing that. He's doing that in all of you. And sometimes he's doing more of it when you feel less like it's happening than on the days when, you know, the ones that look like and feel like good days. So having said that, I'm just going to, I'm trying to get back to the messianic moment, and not the messianic quarter hour. So since I started with Perky Avot, I am going to go on to the next little, that's Perky Fathers. That's just to show that they haven't gotten old and tired, just like the Lord. They're full of sap and green. So I'm kind of attached to saying Perky. Anyway, I'm going to read the next little section. Joshua ben Parahia and Natai, the Arbelite, received from them. Sorry, I'm going to start over. Joshua ben, the printing is very faint and I'm actually having a hard time reading it. Joshua ben Parahiah and Nittai, the Arbelite, received the oral tradition from them. Joshua ben Pariah, not Pariah, Parahiah, used to say, "Appoint for thyself a teacher and acquire for thyself a companion and judge all men with the scale weighted in his favor." I'm going to just adjust it slightly for the sake of the way it reads. Appoint for yourself a teacher and acquire for yourself a companion and judge all human beings with the scale weighted in their favor. What do you think of that? Everyone know what that means? Judge other people with the scale weighted in their favor? It's a very important concept in the Torah that there be just weights and measures. That means that no matter who's buying and selling, if you're using a balance beam, you put a weight that actually weighs what it says on it, not one that's lighter. You may have noticed on gas pumps, there's a little thing that'll say that the pump has been inspected and sealed by a inspector that makes sure that the weights and measures and units are kept accurate. That's to prevent gas stations from going in and adjusting the flow on the pump so that it reads 1 gallon when it's given you, say, 3/4 of a gallon. Or I suppose the most crafty ones don't try for a whole 25% because people might notice that. So maybe they just go 10 or 15% off. And see, then you get less and they make more money. And that is an unjust weight and measure. The state actually puts, I believe, a little wire through the thing and then smashes a lead or tin seal into the thing so that you can't just open it up and you can tell it's been tampered with unless the tamperer is extremely skilled. It matters. So this is saying really that we should be just towards others, and because it's so easy to be biased, that in our own way of thinking, we should actually be more gracious toward them than we might even consider being. And it probably comes back to treat others as you would like to be treated, which is a good concept. I just read in a Facebook comment not long ago that someone who seemed to be aware of certain biblical principles revealed there that they had decided to make their system, I am now going to treat others the way they treat me. It was an interesting interchange between some people I'm not terribly familiar with. But anyway, I won't get off on that. But there's some important things here. Appoint for yourself a teacher. Basically, it just means find somebody that knows more than you and let them teach you from what God's given them. And then beyond that, don't walk alone. Acquire a companion. The scriptures say, woe to him who walks alone, right? If a man walks with his friend or one or two friends and someone attacks them, they can overtake them. But if someone is alone and they're attacked, then they're in trouble. They may be completely overcome. So in our day and age, and particularly, well, in America, there's this notion of being self-sufficient, self-made, not needing anyone, and just figuring it out in your own head, and being proud of it. The scriptures don't glorify such an attitude at all. Not at all. So we all need teachers no matter how much we've learned. And none of us should be walking alone. We need companions that can help us up if we fall and who can act as sounding boards to us regarding our thoughts. So as we express ourselves, they might go, are you sure about that one? I don't know, this passage here seems to say something different. Are you getting off track? Are you feeling okay? How you doing? Let's take a look. Open up and say, let's see what your spiritual life is doing. So keep that in mind. It's good counsel. I was going to read you something again from this book, which I've read parts of before. I don't really know if I have time. I think I'll just make a few comments about the Messianic movement. First of all, and foremost, among any people who are actually balanced at all in their theology and have a decent attitude with respect to their relationship to Yeshua, any Messianic Jewish person or congregation sees itself as a part of the greater body of Messiah. Most of the world, the English-speaking world anyway, calls that the church. I have no problem with calling it the church. It's just that there are different words that can be used for it. The assembly of all those who have faith in Yeshua is another way of saying the church. And then there's the word ecclesia, which we could talk about for an hour, so we won't. But there is not one body that's called the Messianic body and then another body that's called the church. All who have come to Yeshua are brothers and sisters in the Lord of equal value and importance, and they all have a part to play, not necessarily exactly the same part to play. And you know, how interesting would it be if everyone had exactly the same part to play? I'm no expert on football, but I understand that different members of the team have different functions. Some of them spend a lot of time just trying to keep the big guys that knock people down away from the quarterback or whoever's got the ball. They run interference and they just take those other people out when they're trying to get at the person who's carrying the ball at the moment. The body is kind of like that. And the Messianic movement and the rest of the body of Messiah should be like that for each other. They should be supporting each other in their function with God, and the whole family should be helping all the rest of the family fulfill its function. One of the reasons for the Messianic movement is to restore some things that have been lost. I don't know how many people realize this, but within the Messianic movement, there is a great deal of dialogue going on between leaders who have some, you know, that have achieved some level of respect and shown themselves to be sound thinkers and teachers, where there's a broad effort to bring the entire body together as one, instead of a bunch of separate parts doing their own thing. So contrary to what some people think, the vision and purpose of the Messianic movement is not to create a special little group called the Messianic movement that is superior or who's in charge of everyone else or any of those things. It's really to bring balance and to restore what God meant to be from the beginning. So in the very early part of following Yeshua, once the disciples became aware that God was flinging the doors wide open to all the peoples of the earth, anyone who would call on the name of Yeshua, you know, they actually gathered together as one, and they were learning how to conduct themselves in true worship without, you know, people saying, well, this is the right way to worship and that's the right way to worship and you need to do it the way I'm doing it. The right way to do it is to worship the Lord honestly in the presence of other brothers and sisters that you love without letting feelings of competition and jealousness over what you perceive them to have begin to make you want to take what you think they have. And one of the huge tragedies of the history of the church is that, in fact, against the Apostle Paul's instructions, it did begin to act in a way conceited, and the non-Jewish people. Now, there were problems on both sides, but more and more, from what I understand, the evidence is that the non-Jewish part of the body began to actively turn on and exclude the Jewish portion. And of course, that caused wounds on both sides. And I have a deep, deep desire personally to see all those wounds healed so that there would be one body that's functioning as one body in unity together, seeking God and his glory and the fulfillment of his plan of redemption. Okay, I'm going to go on from there, but I ran into something that I found striking, which with respect to this week's Torah portion, which I'm still in the process of looking into. But I was really struck by the order of the beginning of the book of Numbers, and I guess I should just run through a few things. So the book of Numbers, or the Hebrew name is Bamidbar, which is in the wilderness. It's entirely set in the wilderness. Egypt is behind, the promised land is ahead. It's a time of formation in the presence of God. In Numbers, it's the journey of 38 years. They'd already been out there 2 years at this point, but they hadn't gotten in trouble yet. Well, they had gotten in trouble, but they hadn't blown it so bad that they weren't going to make the 11-day journey in a shorter time than 3 or 4 years, let's say, maybe 2 years. So, but they did blow it, and so then they ended up wandering in the wilderness for 38 more years. They're wandering physically and spiritually. So rebellion, failure, complaint, confusion. This is what happened. They rebelled. They failed. They complained. They were confused. They were just all kinds of things. And they go through this long process of all these things, but what it's heading for and ultimately arrives at is a level of maturity that came about in the wilderness. And then they begin to win some battles. And then actually they get to the point where once again, God is going to lead them into the promised land. So what we see is there's a few things in the process is that in God's economy, even people that are hired to curse Israel end up blessing God's chosen people. And the main emphasis in the book is the main emphasis of the book really has to do with spiritual obstacles, not physical obstacles. And the problem is that people lack trust, faith, and courage. And all the other factors are overshadowed by the dominant theme, which is relationship with God. So the issue isn't so much where you're at, what the obstacles are, or the practical things you need, but right down at the bottom of it, the solution always has to do with one not so complicated thing, though we make it so difficult and complex, which is relationship with God. So getting back to the sort of, you know, church Jewish thing, I was really struck by the order of the camp of Israel. And there was something about the mention of the men that stood with Moses that really, really struck me this time around. But I wanted to find a picture of the configuration of the camp of Israel. And I'm going to hold this up, and maybe one or two of you can unmute yourselves and tell me what it looks like when I hold this diagram up. Can you see it?
It looks like a cross.
Yeah.
Okay. So I find this incredibly interesting. This is a map that shows the configuration of the tent of meeting, Levi, and the way Levi is arranged around the tent of meeting. It has the direction called west at the top, where normally, in my experience, north is at the top. But that works better because those are smaller tribes there. And so the ones that are on the east are on the bottom, which would normally be south, with the larger number. So you can make that leg of it look longer in the diagram because of the size of the tribes. And then the ones off to the side are put sideways to, you know, like it's like it just has to be a cross. But when I read the passages, I don't really. I've never gotten that sense that they're in the configuration of a cross. Now, there's another one that's like this, and you know, it's still cross-like. It's not, you know, it's a little bit different. But I'm just thinking, well, is that how they're arranged? I mean, was it a cross? Does it have to be a cross? And I even started thinking logistically then about the way they have it when Judah sets out, because it's Judah that goes first when they begin to march. Somehow Judah has to get past the ones that are outside of him in this cross formation. It seems impractical in a way to me. There must be thousands of these. Unfortunately, I don't have this one printed, but here's another one I don't know if I can get it to, can you see it? Yeah, this one looks kind of more like they're arranged in kind of a square, or maybe more like a circle around there. And you know, and I was thinking in terms of you know, an army arrayed around the headquarters. Not that God needs protection because he's in the center, right? But it doesn't seem like a practical tactical arrangement to be in a strict cross formation either. I mean, nothing, the only thing about it to me that works is that somebody really likes the idea that it looks like a cross. And so we're going to force the configuration to make the shape of a cross, because even before the Messiah came, and even before he was crucified, and even before there was that snake up on that pole out there, we just have to get a cross into the book of Numbers and the configuration of all of Israel. Now, I believe Messiah was in the wilderness with Israel the whole time. I believe that they drank from a spiritual rock that followed them, and it was Messiah. I believe he was with them in the fire and in the cloud the whole time. I believe that though the Orthodox Jews and the secular Jews and the Reconstructionist Jews and the Boo Jews and so many other Jews don't believe that at all, I believe that's the case. But I don't think we have to turn everything in the Mishkan or around the camp into a cross. And frankly, ultimately, to me, it seems offensive, because it's like telling the Jewish people, you know, you're so stupid. Even the shape you traveled in and camped in was a cross, and you're so blind you can't see it. Well, I'm not so sure that we should see a cross there, but I do think we should see Messiah all the time, in everything, even the places where it doesn't look to us like he's there, because the world was founded through him. Everything that was made through him for the glory of the Father. He is the beloved Son. He's the healer of Israel, the Lord of Israel, the King of Israel, the brother and the lover of Israel. He fills everything, and he should be at the core and the center of everything we do and every thought that we think. But we just don't have to impose these things on the history of Israel and make them fit a classic Sunday school church lesson. And I don't actually think it contributes to a deeper understanding. I think it confuses people. So anyway, I'm at this point wondering just how completely accurate a picture of exactly how the camps were configured one can get. I saw some pictures that looked a little more like a circle, not quite so strictly, what would the word be, geometric or anyway, I just found that very, very interesting. So let me see here. I'm trying to watch the time. So I'm just gonna try to throw out a few thoughts here. When I was reading about the configuration of the camp of Israel, I began to think of it in a similar way to, not exactly the same, but but quite similar in principle and in the spiritual sense with the configuration of the members of the body. And I was wondering, did any of you decide to be born?
No.
Any of you think Israel chose itself to be God's people?
No.
After you were conceived, you developed by a process of cell division. Everyone know a little bit about that?
No.
How did someone say no?
Not exactly. You know.
Well, I mean, in the simplest and crudest way of describing it, we began as a single cell, and then it divided into two. And then those two divided into four. And then before long, the number of cells is so many that we'd have a hard time even writing the number out. But and then by some mysterious process, which we all had to concentrate really hard on, right? Those cells began to differentiate into our brain, and our nose, and our toes, and our fingers, and our kneecap, or if you prefer the technical name for kneecap, is it patella? And then, I don't know, somehow, you know, your scapula, and your femur, and your liver, and your heart, and all these parts, and there are so many parts. They formed, and they all began to fulfill their function. And this is all because we worked so hard to get it right, right?
No.
No, it just, well, I don't think it just happened. But thing is, we didn't contribute anything to it. We just got the nourishment that was coming in through our mother, and then finally we were born. And, you know, then we had the responsibility of making a life for ourselves, right? We had to decide what to eat. No, in most cases, our mom took care of us, and we drank, and we just kept getting bigger. We were offered the food, and sometimes we screamed and yelled to make sure that she knew we were hungry, because that's just the way God made us. And then we drank the milk, and we got bigger, and then we started gnawing on things. Many of them weren't even edible, but that helped us get our teeth in and helped us develop our jaw. And then daring mothers began to hand little bits of stuff to us and see what would happen when we took a taste, you know. And we just kept on getting bigger. And we grew and we grew and we grew. So, in one sense, Israel was a baby in the wilderness, and a baby that bit the parent, and that does happen in real life. It happened to me. But the Lord supplied everything that was needed. The Lord was patient. The Lord was faithful. The Lord endured everything that Israel did wrong when it got to the point where, you know, it could do some of its own decision making, which usually it didn't make the right decision when it just decided to make its own. But the thing is, none of it changed God's plan. And whether Israel chose itself or always chose what God asked it to choose, it never changed God's plan. And Israel was always going to fulfill what God chose it for, regardless of how it felt about it or how it thought about it. And God always supplied what was needed, including discipline. And in a similar and much more narrowed down way, our own life is like that. God just keeps leading us along, even when we're not following. He continues to supply what's needed, even when we won't take it. And then he engineers the circumstances so that over and over, we get the opportunity to choose the best, the right thing, which he asks us to choose, and then to more and more become at peace with, oh, this works. If I obey him, it works. The way that he described it begins to happen if I begin to trust him and then you know, eat the necessary food. And then sometimes when I was at a state where I had enough of my own mind to want to be really wise and do it all myself, I realized that he was saying, well, you know, I know you're getting a little big for your britches, but you don't quite know it. But, you know, you still need to drink a little more milk. You need to just grow a little bit, get a little stronger. And then I'm going to give you some pieces of meat. And then we'll see, you know, when you can chew them, swallow them, and they'll go, you're able to digest it, then I'll give you more, but I just want you to trust me. I'm going to do well for you. And so the process is very similar in certain ways. And I just found myself thinking about all the struggle sometimes that people have over what's their place, what's their gift, what's their calling. And I just one more time want to say, in the greatest and deepest sense, your calling is to know God, to come to know his love for you, to love him back, and to learn to sit quietly in his presence while he just shows you what he has. And, you know, the rest is all sort of more incidental. It's not so important just exactly where you're going to be or just exactly what you're going to do or figuring all the details out. I'm not saying they don't matter. But so often, all of that is so confusing because we're struggling and wriggling and clawing to try to get to some place when we may not even be sure where that place is, but we just have this sense of deep urgency that somehow we have to get there. And sometimes we just run off into the woods in the dark thinking that we've got a course of action. And then fortunately, God's merciful, so he designed it so that we end up in the dark and we feel kind of lost. And then we go, oh man, I need Papa. Papa, I'm here. Where are you? And then we might just hear him say, well, I've been right here all along. I've just been whispering, just turn your head and look at me. I love you. I'm going to carry you. I've even been carrying you when you were running. I've never left. And the rock that you can drink from is the same rock as always. And living water is gushing from him. And so just here, let's pick you up, dust you off, wipe the tears out of your eyes, and here, take a drink. And now let's just know each other. Just know me. The rest of it will come out of knowing me, abiding in me, just resting in me. Maybe rest is the, ironically, the hardest work of all. But it actually isn't when you're doing it not hard when you're doing it. It's hard when you're thinking a lot about it and thinking you should do it and racing towards the next thing and planning when you're finally going to do it, when all the while the Lord's just saying, just, you know, my yoke is easy. My burden isn't heavy. And all of those other things will be added to you in the right time if you just trust me. And so I don't know if you think about where you are in the body, but I'm just going to read this passage from 1 Corinthians chapter 12. For even as the body is one and yet has many members, and all the members of the body, though they are many, are one, so also is Messiah. You remember I mentioned a cell division and how, you know, the organs just somehow they just formed and they started functioning? Well, I'm not always sure which organ I am, but I realize that the way conception works is that cell division brings about the formation of something. And so I'm being formed. And if I don't try to run off like a lone foot or something, which is really hard to do if you imagine a foot running away, that the Lord forms things and they begin to function and he supplies what they need. And the body becomes, voila, a body with functioning parts. So then, for by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free. And we were all made to drink of one Spirit, for the one body is not one member, but many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not a part of the body, it is not for that reason any less a part of the body. I find that to be such great news, because when you feel like you're not a part of the body and you say you're not part of the body, you're still part of the body. You just can't unbody yourself. And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I am not a part of the body, it is not for this reason any less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, that would be weird. Where would the hearing be? If the whole were hearing, where would the sense of smell be? But now God has placed the members, each one of them, in the body, just as he desired. Can we let him place us in the body where he desires? It sounds a lot easier and more restful than striving to hardwire ourselves into the circuit board of righteousness and truth with our own head. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? But now there are many members, but one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Or again, the hand to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, it is much truer that the members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. And those members of the body which we deem less honorable, on these we bestow more abundant honor. And our unseemly members come to have more abundant seemliness, whereas our seemly members have no need of it. But God has so composed the body, giving more abundant honor to that member which lacked, that there should be no division in the body, but that the members should have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now, you who are Messiah's body are individually members of it, and God has appointed in the body, the assembly of all those who believe, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healings, helps administrations, various kinds of tongues. All are not apostles, are they? All are not prophets, are they? All are not teachers, are they? All are not workers of miracles, are they? And all do not have gifts of healing, do they? Do not speak with tongues, do they? All do not interpret, do they? But earnestly desire the greater gifts. And, you know, this might be a little bit of a departure. You can get back to me about the theology, but at the moment I'm going to say what the greatest gift is. The greatest gifts are faith, hope, and love. Abide these three. All the rest will come to an end. Love lasts forever. Love never fails. Love continues on. And
that's right.
It's just knowing God. He does know you. He wants to know you. He wants to engage more in the knowing of each other together. He really loves you, wants to know you. And whatever you think of all the other parts of the body, remember, they depend on you. You depend on them, they depend on you. But we all depend on Messiah, who is the head of everything, and the beginning and the end of everything, and the proof and the power and the way to the fulfillment of everything. And he has what we need. And the most vast wilderness is just a place of peace and sustenance if we're gazing into his eyes. So love yourself. Love everybody else. And in order to do that, love God first. And he's going to add the rest. We've already got most everything. The rest is just commentary.
Amen.
So I think I'm done. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'yichunecha. Yisa Adonai panav elecha v'yasem lecha shalom.